Hello and welcome to the National Oceanography Centre's Into the Blue podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Zoe Jacobs. In today's episode, we'll be joined by Dr. Tammy Horton on a voyage to meet the monsters of the deep and the mysterious discovery collections. Welcome, Tammy. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Hi, it's a pleasure.
Good, it's good to see you. So before we kind of get into it, I wondered if you could tell me a bit about your career and your role at NOC, because I believe you have two main roles here.
Yeah, that's right. So I started here at NOC in 2001, so I've probably been here a very long time now. And I came directly after my PhD. So I had done a PhD on something completely unrelated to deep sea science and completely unrelated. I was looking at parasitic isopods that live in the mouths of fish.
So, Yeah.
So rather strange. And there was a new species to the UK. Mm-hmm. And I spent quite a lot of time at the Natural History Museum in London. And that's where I learned about taxonomy and the study of understanding how to determine what species things are.
Right.
So identifying animals and also describing animals new to science.
Oh, cool. Sounds really interesting.
So that was my introduction to taxonomy and crustaceans, these animals, some of which we have in front of us here. But I started at the NOC in 2001 on a fellowship, which was to study the biodiversity of the deep sea. And I continued working at NOC for many years on a number of different projects. And I eventually took over looking after the discovery collections in about 2013.
Okay.
And so now I have, a dual role. So I balance my own research, which is on describing new species of deep sea crustaceans, with looking after these many specimens in the discovery collections.
Yeah, that sounds really interesting. So what are the discovery collections?
So the discovery collections, right. They've got a long history, and the discovery collections are essentially all of the biological samples and specimens that have been collected by the ships named Discovery and all of the other ships that the institutes who've held the ships named Discovery.
Lots of ships.
So although it's called the Discovery Collections, and it was named after the ships, there have been a number of other ships alongside, so it's not only Discovery.
Yeah.
So I have to add that little little thing in there, which says, you know, don't forget about the Challenger ships and the James Cooks and all of these other ships. But yes, all of the biological samples that are collected by those ships come back and have always come back to a collection of biological specimens, and that is what makes up the Discovery collections.
So why do we have it?
Why do we keep all these things in jars? Well, a lot of people think it's quite strange to keep deceased animals in jars for posterity, but there is a scientific reason, there are lots of scientific reasons why we do so. So a sample of animals from a point in time and point in space provides us a picture of what lived there at that time. If we go back even the next day, the next week, certainly in the next year, we'll find something different there, more than likely, a completely different community. So we keep these specimens so that we can study the communities that live in a particular area at a particular place and in time and space. So it provides us with a scientific understanding of what lives in our oceans. That's one of the things, but there's so many more things, so many more reasons why we keep specimens.
So you say we talked about all of these kind of specimens have come from like so many different ships, and I know there have been quite a few discoveries. So how long have we been collecting these specimens?
Right. Well, some of the first ever expeditions down to the Southern Ocean and Antarctica began in 1925.
Oh, wow.
And I can show you, I've got this fantastic volume here, which was published, I think, in 1929, which is the Discovery Investigations, Objects and Equipment.
Wow. And so like, methods. That's nearly 100 years ago then.
Yeah. So we're almost at 100 years since we started collecting things for the Discovery Collections. And if we look inside this beautiful book, and I'm showing you now a picture of the Royal Research Ship Discovery. This is the first iteration of the Discovery.
Oh,
and that went to that on the first commission of the Discovery investigations to the Southern Ocean for on an expedition lasting 2 years. Now, can you imagine that being?
Yeah, I'm all I can think right now is that looks very different to the Discovery that I know.
Exactly. So there's been four iterations of the Discovery vessels now. So we're on Discovery 4, I like to say. So Discovery 1, this one, lasted the first 2 years and still collected a lot of the specimens and samples, including what I'm holding up now. This one here was collected in 1927. So this was collected.
Is that one of the oldest or the oldest specimens?
It's one of the oldest. Yeah. Not the oldest, but it's one of the oldest ones we have in our collections here in Southampton. And this is some rather large barnacles, which were collected at the surface, actually. And we're not sure exactly where we have the station data here. So every single specimen that we have has information about the stations. Mm-hmm. And we return to the volumes and the cruise reports, which is kind of what we do now, to find out the exact latitude, longitude of where the collection took place.
Yeah. Oh, wow. That's
so this
cool.
is one of our oldest specimens.
That's so cool.
It's beautiful.
I should mention, actually, for those of you who are listening to the podcast, we actually have a YouTube channel as well. So if you'd like to move over to Nock's YouTube channel, then you can actually see what all these kind of cool specimens that we're looking at here.
And this other jar I have in front of me, it's a bit heavy. It just says jar 5 on the outside, which suggests there were 4 more.
That
least.
Just looks like cotton wool to me.
Well, that is cotton wool at the top there.
Go.
So yeah, you were
there's
right.
More,
well
there's
done.
More interesting stuff underneath.
But in underneath that we have these nematine worms.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And this is how they would have been sorted and separated on board the ship when they were doing this in the 1920s and 30s.
Wow.
And they were very good at it back then. You know, they had experts on board who could sort and identify all of the animals and give them names and preserve them properly and put them into the jars like this. And this may not have been open since that time, actually. So this is 1930s. So these are some of the oldest samples we
and
have.
Where, do you know where that one came from?
Well, this one's actually a collection of lots of different samples from different
from
places.
Over, yeah.
Yeah, so it's lots of different stations. So it has the stations listed on the outside because these are all of that type of worm.
Got it.
That's been collected perhaps during that commission to the Southern Ocean. So they were, in total, there were 9 expeditions between 1925 when these investigations began and 1950.
Oh, right.
And most of that material is now held at the Natural History Museum in London. Okay. We have some of it here.
Yeah.
We don't have the space to retain it all.
Yeah.
So some of the older material is up in London. But
wow.
We still continue to collect every year for here in Southampton.
Oh, that's cool. So, I mean, we've been collecting them then for nearly 100 years. Is how we collect them any different now compared to the 1920s and 30s?
Yeah. So there's some changes and there's some things which have stayed almost exactly the same. So if we think about the changes of how we collect, we've got more modern ships, as I've just shown you.
Yeah,
so it's not a sailing ship anymore.
No.
We run on diesel these days. And so the technology on the ship is much more advanced. Mm-hmm. But the actual physical methods are rather similar. So we used to use, back then they would have used trawl nets and tangle nets and dredges.
Yeah.
And we still use trawl nets.
Yeah.
We use corers now to take samples of the seabed as well. And we look at the smaller animals in those. And of course we have the wonderful advent of photography.
Mm-hmm.
So we can now visualize the seafloor, which is something that they couldn't do back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
You know, so there was a long time where there was a sampling blind.
Yeah.
So we're much further on in that, in that we can see what we're sampling now. But as far as once the samples get back on shore and how we look after them now, those techniques are largely unchanged. So we still preserve the animals in the same way using the same chemicals. So it's formaldehyde or alcohols.
Mm-hmm.
The other picture I also have in this wonderful volume back from 1925 shows you that the jars that we use were exactly the same. So this picture here, and I'm showing you a volume here with, they even took, made drawings of the jars that we used. And as you can see here, we have jars which are the same as the ones which you have in front of you. All right, so these are, you can recognise exactly which jars.
Yes, you can.
So, and some of these are more modern jars or things that I have used more recently rather than the really old ones. So I recycle and reuse old jars.
Yep.
We only replace them when they break.
Yes.
So yes, the actual methodology of back on shore of how we're looking after the samples and specimens and how we sort and identify them, that's not really changed.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually. I wasn't sure if I was expecting that to kind of be the same or not.
Well, I mean, there obviously there's improvements. I
mean,
being able to see what's down there.
Yeah,
with a live link. I mean, how much things have changed there. It's staggering to be able to watch live an ROV camera looking at these animals swimming in the deep oceans as you can now is just amazing. And every scientist who has worked on specimens that have been long dead in preservative, being able to see those things in their natural habitat live is just a joy. It really is.
Oh, that's amazing. That's so true, actually. I didn't think about that, like kind of going in blind. So they literally, quite often couldn't even see the samples that they were...
No, I mean, well, and a lot of our sampling is still done like that.
Yeah.
So we still do a trawl without a camera attached.
Yes.
But more often the ROV samples, the more selective sampling that we do these days, will bring back nicer specimens. So obviously a trawl will damage the specimens.
That's true, yeah, of course.
But a camera guided, picking up a single specimen and putting it into a tube, you'll have beautiful specimens that way.
Yeah, that's true.
So yeah, it's a big change. It's a game changer.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, it's really, really cool. So how many specimens do we actually have in the collections?
Okay, so we don't know. But I'm sure. Think we can have a ballpark estimate.
Okay.
So we count jars.
Yes.
So we think we've got 70,000 jars.
Word. Okay.
In our collections here in Southampton. There's about equivalent number of jars, the older material. I call it the historic discovery collections up at the Natural History Museum in London. So about 70,000 jars. Now, if I show you this jar again, and you look at how many worms are
inside,
in that jar.
That's true,
So one jar can contain, like this jar, one specimen, or it can contain possibly 400, like this one.
I was gonna say hundreds,
So if we have 70,000 jars, we're on the order of millions of specimens, and we don't have an up-to-date count of that at the moment. But that's something I'm working on.
Yeah.
It's a long job.
Trying to do an inventory.
Yeah. The inventory of what we have is a major job.
Oh my gosh, it sounds like it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, if there's like more than 100,000, I can imagine that's going to take quite a while.
No, more than millions. Millions of specimens.
Oh, specimens, yeah.
Specimens,
jars, gosh.
Yep.
Crazy.
And it's growing every year.
Yeah, I bet.
So we're out collecting and bringing more samples back every year as part of major programs that are funded still.
Wow. And where do all these specimens come from? We've talked about a few being from the Southern Ocean. I guess they're just coming from everywhere, right?
Yeah, well, we've had different focus over time. So as I've mentioned, the historic discovery collections, that was funded by the government to study the ecosystems of the whales.
So that
was at a time when we were using whale oil and whale meat, and they wanted to understand how that was impacting the ecosystem of the whales in the Southern Ocean. So 9 major commissions down to the Southern Ocean and around that area over 25-year period was funded to make that study. So all of that sampling is really Southern Ocean.
Yeah.
But after the 1950s, focus of our attention moved to the North Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was the change in focus from the government, as these things often are, moved. And since then, we've largely focused, or we were at that point mostly focused on the North Atlantic. There was a major campaign to the Indian Ocean, or a number of campaigns in the 1960s to the Indian Ocean. And we've been back there a few times in smaller campaigns over, you know, 3-year periods. But now we have a major focus still on the North Atlantic, but it's on our Porcupine Abyssal Plain, it's called our local abyssal area. And we continue to make smaller focused projects, 3-year projects as they're funded, to various other places around the world. It depends where the ships are going and what's funded. Yeah. So we have samples from the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. We have samples from the Cayman Islands. We have samples from the Deep Pacific and Indian Oceans, Southwest Indian Ocean, everywhere, really. We're very lucky.
Yeah, that's really good. And like, I'm just imagining the whole range of types of specimens that we have in the collections. And I can just see them. If you're watching on the YouTube channel, you can just see.
This is a very small selection.
Exactly. It's a small selection, but I can already see the kind of different kinds of specimens that we have. Can you tell us a bit about the range of...
Yeah, so the majority of our samples are invertebrate samples.
Okay.
So animals without a backbone.
Yep.
So we don't focus on fish. They are all marine. So obviously we're not looking at freshwater animals or terrestrial animals. Mm-hmm. And that is the unique focus of the collections, really, is that it is devoted to the deep sea bed and open ocean midwater animals over the years, because we have had focus on whether we're working on the deep sea bed or in all of those weird animals that live in the pelagic area, the midwater. but everything is deep sea, or it's certainly offshore. So we don't have... hardly any specimens that are less than 500 meters deep or from less than 500 meters deep. And an incredible range, diversity of animal types.
Yeah.
So we have, just looking in front of me, we've got crustaceans here, two types of crustaceans, an arthropod called a sea spider. We've got holothurians, which are sea cucumbers. And I have bought some fish species because everybody loves fish. whenever I talk to people about the Discovery Collections, they want to know about the fish because they're often the most exciting.
Yeah.
Or what people think are the most exciting, but that's because they haven't met all the other invertebrates.
This is true.
Yet. And down there at the front, we've got a cephalopod. So it's an octopod.
Ooh.
And that particular one, I don't know if you can read the second part of the name of it, is called Grimpertuthis Discoveryi. And that's named after the ship.
Oh, that's exciting.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, we have a vast array of things down there. And the beauty of it is that we have the full range of all the animals, from larger animals down to absolutely tiny protozoans, small animals, everything. And that means that scientists who want to study the sorts of things that we have a very good collection of it.
Yeah, I can see. what's the most, what would you say the most interesting specimen you have is, or you've seen?
Oh, I find that very, very difficult.
I know, I was going
to
say.
It's kind of one of the worst questions to ask me, because every day that I'm working in the collections, I'll come across something new and exciting. And go, wow, have you seen this? I'm talking to myself when I'm doing this. Wow, have you seen this, Tammy? You found this in the collection. There's generally only me. But for me, it's the crustaceans, because that's what I work on in my own research. I really love the sea spiders. So I'm holding one up now. This is a giant sea spider. Called Colossendaeus colossea, which basically means giant.
I was going to say,
And I think these are fascinatingly weird animals. This one in the jar is all kind of curled up, but when you see them in video footage, again, which you can their legs extend out to the size of a dinner plate and bigger. And they'll be walking incredibly slowly across this abyssal seafloor. They're just wonderfully weird. And the interesting thing about them is, this is a giant version, but we do get sea spiders just out there on the shore in Southampton. So we get sea spiders everywhere.
Yeah.
But they're tiny, weeny things. So they're, a centimetre long at most. But we can find their cousins on our seashore. But the deep sea ones and the polar ones, the Antarctic ones, are giants.
Yeah.
They're amazing. So they're my favourites. But I know there's lots of other favourites that other people have. I also love, of course, the giant isopod that we have.
Oh, yeah.
We only have one of those because they're not found around our coasts.
Okay.
So that was brought back to the collections by Paul Tyler, who was working in the Gulf of Mexico various cruises at the time. He collected that, and that has come back to knock and is now held here. It's used for teaching and things like this. And if you've not seen a giant isopod before, they're like a big woodlouse, but a really, really big woodlouse that you're never going to meet, so don't worry. But they're, you know, this sort of size, so yeah. 30 centimetres
yeah,
long.
Like
so
it's a foot in length.
Really, really big. Yeah. And again, they're scavengers that live on the deep sea bed. Mm. And you can see those in video footage now as well. It's just amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. What about this fish-looking thing we have in the big tool jar?
Oh, so this big one here, this this sad-looking creature. Aww. He's got a really sad face. But he's a type of rat tail. So rat tails are very important scavengers, again, in the deep sea, and they're very common. But this particular type we found in the collections, again, one of my students did, Jethro, he found this specimen in the collections and identified it for me, because I'm not the best at fish, I'm a crustacean taxonomist. So I rely on lots of other people to do identifications, and my student identified this one as Macroroides inflatisseps. Now I call it the tadpole fish.
I can
see
why.
It looks like a giant tadpole.
Giant tadpole,
yeah. It's not. It's I think it's called the inflated rat tail, because it's got a large inflated head. But it's just a beautiful animal, and we've only got one. Yeah. And some of our specimens that are rarer, we try to display and showcase to the public. And I've got a lot of videos that we've made about these star specimens, things that we that are rarer. So the giant isopod and giant sea spider, things that really inspire people to study more about the deep sea. We've made some videos, and they're on they're available to see on the YouTube channel.
Oh, that's really cool. Out of interest, what's the largest specimen that we have? Would it be the isopod? Or do we have even bigger
ones? We've got big fish. We've got some really big, like these ones, the rat tails, the macrurids. We've got some of those downstairs in the collections, and they can be up to a metre and a half length.
Yeah, awesome.
But we don't have the capacity to store them very well, because how many jars do you see that are that
big?
Well,
yeah, exactly.
So we tend to have to use large barrels for that. And we don't tend to retain the fish. We try to work more on the invertebrates, because other people specialize on fish. But we have got some very large fish down there. Yeah. So that's probably the largest specimens that we have.
I'm just imagining like a kind of dimly lit aquarium with like all these kind of funky.
And we don't have
creatures.
Any giant squid either. Oh. But we do have giant squid beaks.
Oh, right? There you go.
So, yeah. So there they were collected. back in the early days of the historic discovery collections. And I should have brought those down, but I didn't bring them with me today.
Next time.
Yeah, but giant squid beaks are, if you've ever eaten a squid or seen a squid, they have inside these little beaks that looks like a parrot beak.
Yeah.
Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, I have,
So they're quite small, aren't they? And you have to take them out in order to eat a squid. Now, the giant squid beak that we've got is, you know, it's about that sort of size, parrot beak.
Parrot beak size.
If you imagine bigger than a parrot beak.
Oh, bigger
size,
than parrots.
Yeah, so my hand size, this.
Oh, wow.
And you can imagine the size of the squid scaling it up.
Yeah.
But they were found in sperm whale stomachs. When the original discovery investigations, they did lots of whale studies as well as part of those investigations.
Oh, wow. There you go.
We've got some weird stuff.
Yeah. I can see just by the ones in front of me. So how do all these specimens contribute to ocean science today?
Right. Well, I've said at the beginning that there's so many things that specimens can do for us.
Yeah.
One of the major things and the focus of my research is taxonomy. Yeah. So that's describing the new species that we find. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I mean, it's a fundamental part of all biological studies is knowing what animal you're studying.
Right, yeah.
So if you want to understand how an animal is processing carbon, for example, or transporting carbon, or how it's respiring. Mm-hmm. The first thing you have to know is what is it?
Yeah.
Not how is it respiring?
Yeah.
If you want to write a publication or study something in more detail, the first thing is what is it?
Yeah.
Okay, so that is absolutely a fundamental building block of all biological science is taxonomy. So there's one thing. So in addition to that, we want to make to understand what is in the oceans and how it is changing. So if we think about climate change and things like ocean acidification, we need to be able to say what lived at a place at a particular point in time, which is what I explained at the start.
Yes, exactly,
this is what our sampling gives us. So we, although I've got all of these animals in separate jars, what we're actually looking at when we're building, when we're studying them and when we bring them on the deck is a community of animals. We're not just looking at this fish here and this sea spider here. We're looking at all of the animals that live in a particular place.
Yeah.
And so as scientists, what we do is we collect the animals or we sample an area and then we identify everything that lives there and count how many of each of the things are there. And then we can possibly go back and look at how that's changed the next year, the next 5 years. And this is called an environmental baseline.
Yeah.
So it's like a baseline picture of what lives there. Without a good, strong baseline, we can't say how the environment is changing. So that's a large part of what the research, that the contribution to ocean science is environmental change. And we're doing this on an annual basis at the Porcupine Abyssal Plain, which is one of our major study areas. So that is just off, if you carry on for a very long way or about a day's sail off of Southwest Ireland, you'll get to something, an area called the Porcupine Abyssal Plain. And that our study site there is 4,850 metres deep, so almost 5 kilometres.
Wow.
Have you ever run 5 kilometres?
Yep.
If you do your couch to 5K, right?
Yeah,
it takes you about half an hour. Well, it takes me about half an hour.
At least.
Some people can do it quicker.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, if you imagine running straight down for half an hour, that's how far it is. It's a really long way down.
It's such a long way down.
Yeah. And when you just say 4,000 metres or whatever, or Bissell Plain, it's very difficult to quantify how far that is. But I like to think of it as the 5K run straight down.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah. It's good to visualise it.
Yeah. So we collect samples. We sample the entire water column. So there's scientists who are studying, looking at what's happening in the upper ocean and at the flux down towards the seabed. And our part and the Discovery Collections part is looking at the animals right on the seabed. So we trawl the sample, the seabed, and we take cores, sediment cores, and we look at the tiny little animals that live in there. And every year we bring them back and we sort them out, identify them, count them. And there's about, I think it's about 2,000 animals of the bigger animals per year, not including all the tiny weeny animals. And my own research, I also look at the little amphipod shrimps that are collected there. So so it's a major study area. And we've been doing this process since 1989.
Oh, right.
And 1985 for the scavenging amphipods, which I study. So it's a really long-term study, and it's pretty much the only one in the world that looks at those things over time at abyssal depths. So it's a unique global study.
Yeah, that's great. Out of interest, have you noticed any changes over that time period?
Yes, there's been a lot of change. So we're still going out there every year, but we have seen decadal scale changes of orders of magnitude in particular the holotherians, which are sea cucumbers. I mustn't use the funny word, the holotherian word. So sea cucumbers, and now I'm holding up an example here. This one's called Dima. This is a sea pig. It's common name sea pig, so people may know it as a sea pig. They're cute little things. We've got those, and then there should be possibly by you a big purple thing which looks like a giant tongue.
Big.
Yep.
One of these
so
ones.
That is Benthodites. That's another big sea cucumber. Now, sea cucumbers on the deep sea bed they're kind of roaming around on the abyssal sea floor, processing all the sediment, eating all the things, which falls like manna from heaven.
Yeah.
So everything floats down. These marine snow arrives on the seabed, and the animals like the holotherians, which are really important in the deep sea, are going around, eating it up, processing all this fresh detritus from above. And we've seen changes of an order of magnitude in the sea cucumbers at the deep sea bed in particular years have seen huge great abundances, and you know, you go back the next year or the next few years and it's gone right down to nothing. And it's something that we're now looking at across all of the invertebrates at the seabed, and we think it's to do with the change in quality and quantity of flux of the detritus, the manna, the food that they're feeding on.
Food source,
And that is, of course, impacted by change in the upper ocean.
Yes.
So we're effectively seeing change, possibly climate change.
Yeah.
5 kilometers deep.
Yeah. Wow, that kind of goes back to the previous podcast where we had Steph Henson.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about how important all the different interactions are between all the different layers and all the different organisms and everything. Gosh, that's really interesting.
So what Steph is doing, she's looking at the flux.
And the
plankton poo, which she talks about. So she's talking about the plankton poo. That plankton poo is what eventually reaches, is the food for these sea cucumbers. So the change at that, she's looking at changes.
Yeah.
We're looking at changes in that. She's looking at how that changes as flux changes and what impacts.
Yeah.
Making, but that's the great thing about working here at NOC is that we work together collaboratively with people in different fields. You know, we're looking at these sea cucumber numbers and they're looking at the plankton poo that's feeding our sea cucumbers.
Exactly. Yeah. So just so interesting. I'm kind of like mesmerized by these jars in front of me.
Every day.
I know, I can imagine. I understand.
I don't get much done.
So can anyone come and see the collection?
Well, this collection is a little bit closed because we're not a public museum,
right?
But we do accept visitors scientific visitors who want to study the collections. But there is opportunities to visit the specimens currently in an exhibition down in the National Maritime Museum in Falmouth in Cornwall.
Oh, okay.
And it's called Monsters of the Deep.
Ooh.
And it's a fantastic exhibition because it's not just about my samples. It follows the legends and the stories of monsters, because back in the day here be monsters, wasn't it? It was written on the maps. Here be monsters. And so it follows that story of these legends of sea monsters, and it's the legend and the reality. And so right at the end of the exhibition is, you know, they've talked all the way about the monsters, but then we talk about the real monsters. So people consider these monstrous. But some people do. And so they showcase the real monsters of the deep at the end of the exhibition. So you can go down there and you can see these star specimens. And there's video footage of each of the star specimens and a subset of the Discovery collections. And Boaty McBoatface is down there as well. So you can learn about oceanography
and see
some of the models of the ship. And the original Challenger laboratory has been recreated down there.
Oh, great.
So it's a fantastic exhibition, and it goes on until January 2023.
Yeah.
At which point I've got a lot of work to do to bring everything back.
Yes, I can imagine.
Check it all over and then move it to Chatham in Kent.
It's on tour.
Yes, it's on tour. It's going to Chatham Historic Dockyard, and that opens, I think, in April 23. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a lot of work between early next year to get it all moved and reset up.
That's great. Well, now everyone knows where to go and have a look if they would like to. Thanks so much for joining us today. It's been really, really interesting, especially to hear all about them, but also for me to see all of them as well. It's been really great.
It's a pleasure.
And if you'd like to learn more about the Discovery Collections, visit our website noc.ac.uk and head over to our Under the Surface pages. If you'd like to see some of the monsters of the deep with your own eyes, head over to our YouTube channel to watch this episode, as well as some star specimens. We'll see you in the next episode.